This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Lana. Thanks for being here. All of you know, yesterday in Belgium, the world saw another attack by hostile invaders. Not one mainstream news reporter or analyst pointed to the open border policy of Europe, where millions are now flooding into the EU unchecked. It's unbelievable. And it's quite simple. If we want to stop terrorism and violence, stop mass non-European immigration into Europe. Stop importing it. In fact, we should be busy with mass deportations right now. I'm so tired of hearing, not all Muslims, just a few extremists, blah, blah. I don't care. Islam does not belong in Europe. Non-Europeans who resent Western culture certainly do not belong in Europe. There are plenty of Muslim countries where these people can go, but they don't because they want to deplete the generous European welfare system while they push Islam onto our continent, colonizing our land with our tax dollars. Doesn't this outrage you? It outrages me, and I cannot understand the psyche of white liberals who want these hostile invaders around them. Our traitor politicians won't stop Islam in Europe, but the waking white giant will. I firmly believe this. Once Europeans start fighting back, invaders won't stand a chance. After all, they need us to survive. We are not in the position of weakness. I was very disappointed with Utah and Idaho, who voted for Slimeball Cruz last night. I heard Mormons in Utah saying that Trump is too tough on Muslims and immigration. This was said on the same day Europeans were killed by suicide bombers in Europe. How did white people get so cucked? After the Belgium attack, many people were tweeting how Europeans deserved the attack. Israelis, Arabs, Pakistanis, blacks, Muslim students in Belgium, and white students in America said white Europeans deserve to be blown up by terrorists. Do you really think these people are going to treat whites well as a minority? Meanwhile, Obama was in Cuba giving an incredibly anti-white speech, saying things like, Cuba was built by African slaves, and we live in a European colonized world, said with disgust, while at the same time calling on white people to help communist Cuba. Obama even slipped in praises of Nelson Mandela, the mass-murdering communist. It's unbelievable how much anti-white propaganda he slips into his speeches. Europeans built Cuba. Communism came, those Europeans left, and everything went to hell. And now they need those racist European colonizers to help bring life back to Cuba? Just about an hour ago, I heard another Obama speech where he basically said, Muslims in America are integrated, but not in Europe, because those evil Europeans don't make them feel at home, and so it's their fault for the attack. There's no living with those who harbor such hostility and hatred of whites. We are already divided, and we should encourage further division to separate from anti-whites. Divide, divide, divide. Why would we ever want to live with people who hate us? Interesting that today also happens to be Purim, the rabbinic festival of revenge on the Gentiles. Oy vey, folks. My special guest today is James Edwards, the founding host of The Political Cesspool, a talk show on AM radio in the U.S. The program is now in its 11th year. Over the course of the past decade, his work on the radio has also been the subject of articles in over 250 newspaper and magazine publications around the world. His first book was released in 2010. I'll let him tell you more. James was recently the subject of many headlines, such as white supremacist radio host got press credentials for Trump event, white supremacists are broadcasting from inside Trump rally, and more. We'll talk about this, the pro-white movement, lamestream media lies, secession, and much more. James Edwards coming up next. Welcome, James. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here, Lana. You know, for the benefit of your audience, I would just like to take a moment to share that over the course of the last 2 weeks, I've been contacted by virtually every major media outlet in the United States and plenty others from around the world. We're talking about the Washington Post and the New York Times and the New York Daily News and Reuters, Newsweek. Just yesterday, I received 3 emails from the Wall Street Journal, UK Daily Mail, on and on and on, MSNBC, CNN. I have not talked to any of them. I refuse to. It's been my policy for the last couple of years to just flat out reject any interview request unless it's live, unedited television or radio. And so we've turned them all down. But when I got an interview request from Radio 314, that was a much different story. When Radio 314 speaks, I listen. And I might add, happy belated birthday.
Oh, well, thank you. Someone's paying attention.
We have a great research team down here in Memphis.
Well, I'm delighted to make a new friend fighting the same fight. I always get excited when I discover new popular shows like yours and just get to connect. So thanks for being here.
Well, that's what we were talking about. Well, again, the pleasure is entirely mine. And we were talking about this shortly before we started taping. And that is, you know, we've been around for 11 years. My radio program's been around for 11 years, and it's made a lot of news. And there's a lot of things that have happened that I think are very interesting. And we have a pretty robust portfolio. But it just goes to show the true diversity of what our movement is becoming. When we went on the air 11 years ago, I always hesitate to do a listing of names and organizations because you always leave someone out that should be mentioned. But back in 2004, when we first went on the air, when it comes to people who are explicitly fighting on behalf of Europeans and European Americans, you had just a handful. Certainly David Duke, mm-hmm. You had Stormfront and Don Black, Jared Taylor and American Renaissance, Kevin McDonald was on the scene. You had NPI, although that was before Richard came in and really took that to the next level. There were a few, and then there was us, but not many. And now it's just
It's rapidly growing, isn't it?
Well, look at Twitter. I mean, look, you know, when we went on the air, think about this. When we went on the air in 2004, Twitter was not even around yet. That came a couple of years later. And 2004 was the year that Facebook first went online. So that's how far back we go. And now I look around and you've got people out there, just everyday people with thousands and thousands of Twitter followers who are putting forth great things along our lines. So it's just amazing. The snowball effect over the course of the last decade has been staggering, and it continues to grow and continues to multiply. And we're really reaching a critical mass. It's an exciting time to be involved in this struggle.
We definitely are. And I think that we could use Trump to our advantage. And I want to get into that later. But I just want to say, you know, you're young, you're driven, you're passionate. You've appeared on numerous TV shows and in publications. So how did you get Political Cesspool going?
Well, you know, I never had a dream. It was never my intention from birth to get into radio, you know. And one thing that separates us, and I think is the reason why we have been such fixtures in the media from 2004, we talk about a message that you're not supposed to talk about, but we're also on AM radio. And being on AM terrestrial radio, obviously our internet audience is great, and what people are doing with the internet cannot be discounted. It's incredible work. But that gives us a little bit different legitimacy, I think, because there's very few people, if any, that are doing what we're doing on AM radio. And with regard to how I got there, I always, since I became politically aware, and I was born into a Southern family, dare I say a conservative family, so we always had good instincts with regard to issues. But I got involved politically in my late teens, mid to late teens. People who are familiar with my work will know this. We talk about this on all the anniversary shows, how it started and where we've gone from then. But I started with Pat Buchanan, and I worked for Pat during his last presidential campaign. And I got hooked, and it was something that was into me. And I began to cultivate a better knowledge and understanding of racial realities, and certainly began to make my initial inquiries into the Jewish question back in those years in the late 90s and the early 2000s. And then after that campaign was over, it was, you know, what do? You look for other ways to apply yourself. You look for other doors that you can open and unlock. And so in 2002, I ran for a seat in the Tennessee State Legislature. I was 21 years old. I turned 22 that summer. And we actually ran a pretty credible campaign, if I say so myself. Of course, I was naive enough to believe that just because I was full of piss and vinegar and a lot of motivation and charisma that I could go out there and take on the Speaker of the House and win. But it didn't quite happen that way. But we did get a little less than 20% in a three-way race, running as a unknown 21-year-old independent. And so when that ended, we had raised just enough of a profile in the local community to where an opportunity to go on the radio presented itself. And I got a call and they said, you know, you do want to do a talk show, and the rest is history. So that started in October of 2004.
Well, recently I came across a couple headlines. Let me read them. Okay. White supremacist radio host got press credentials for Trump event. White supremacists are broadcasting from inside Trump rallies. Trump campaign gives press credentials to pro-slavery white nationalists. And of course, they were talking about you. So how did lamestream liars discover your attendance at the Trump rally?
Well, they listened to the show, apparently, because we you know, of course, made mention of it when we broadcasted live that night. I believe it was the last or the first Saturday in March, because we're live every Saturday night. You know, it's a set schedule, obviously. And so I guess they just listened to it, and we posted it to our website. And this isn't the first time that we've made national news. It happens occasionally. But with Trump being involved in this, it took on a life of its own. We have been, of course, defamed and libeled and slandered as all of these, you know, with all of these slurs for as long as we've been talking. The first year we were on the air, it started, and it's just never let up. But with Trump, it became much more intense because, of course, they are desperately trying, the media is desperately trying to discredit him and to derail him, and he seems impervious to that. He has really run a flawless campaign. But sure enough, anyway, we were there, and they picked up on it. And the headlines, I had Jared on my show, Jared Taylor, a couple of weeks ago, and he said that, and of course, he would be one of maybe a handful of people who have received, you know, that are on our side of the fence, that have received more press than I have over the course of the last 10 years. And David would be another. But he said that he had never seen the media come down as hard on anyone as they came down in this instance. And the whole pro-slavery thing, white supremacist, I mean, that's to be expected. But pro-slavery was something that, you know, if you go to our website, I think we take great care and thoughtfully and professionally and responsibly addressing our issues. You know, certainly when you are talking about these issues, you have to do it in a way that is going to be appealing, because it's an uphill battle to begin with the way that your detractors are going to seek to frame you. And if you go to our website, it lists a lot of our bona fides, and I think some of them are pretty remarkable. For instance, you know, even here in Memphis, before the media decided to recast us and to rebrand us, we received a certificate of recognition for outstanding contributions to the community as a result of our work on the radio.
Nice.
And I was even named an honorary Memphis City Councilman. So we've got all of this stuff up there. If you just take a quick look at our website, it looks to be exactly what it is, which is a mainstream venue, if I say so myself. Just because we talk about things that other people would rather us not talk about doesn't take away who we are. And so you look through the guests we've had, and we've had sitting members of the United States Congress on our show. We've had people like Pat Buchanan on our show many times. We've had Hollywood actors, A-listers on the program. They overlook all of that. Let me just quickly tell you how the media works with regards to this. They overlooked all of that. They could have put any of that in there, but that's not going to make quite as salacious of a story. And it's certainly not going to be something they can use to beat Trump over with, even if they said he appeared on a controversial radio show, which would be factual. We are controversial. But they didn't write that. They wrote pro-slavery. Now, where did they come up with that? They had to go all the way back to a very obscure blog post that I put up in August of 2008. August of 2008, they had to do it all the way back to August of 2008. A black writer for the Jamaican Observer wrote an article entitled "Slavery Was the Greatest Thing to Ever Happen to Black People." And he talked about the benefits of them being able, the descendants of the slaves being able to live in a first world country, and all of the amenities and luxuries and freedoms that they enjoy in America and throughout the West that they don't have in Africa still to this day. And of course, slavery still exists, but it exists exclusively in non-white countries, but we don't want to talk about that.
That's right.
And anyway, so I basically just said, I agree with him. And that was it. And that's up there. And I didn't take it down. You know, I don't take things down. I don't apologize. I don't recant when we come under fire, because that's not going to win you anything. It's not like these people are going to change their minds. I don't even know if they really believe it themselves. But anyway, that's how the whole pro-slavery narrative came into play, because I agreed with a black writer when he wrote that, which was a very sensible piece. And I commend this guy for saying something that truthful in today's political climate. But that's how that started. And they ran with that. And I have never, you know, even all my years, we've never been labeled as pro-slavery. But that was written as a matter of fact. And it was all over the place. And you know, of course, it reached the Trump campaign.
Another line I saw is James Edwards is the host of an openly pro-white radio show that is unapologetically white. You know, the shock and horror because you don't have white guilt. So I bet the Vulture reporters, they could probably smell that you were different. You know, you didn't have the stench of that white guilt coming off of you. So how was the interaction with other reporters there? Did they try and talk to you at all?
No, you know, I wrote about that. I wrote a little essay documenting my experience at the Trump rally. And I did take a moment to get a picture with Katie Tour. I went over and talked to Katie Tour, who is a, I don't know what she is. She's with NBC, but she's a Trump beat reporter. But the only reason I did that was because her former lover, Keith Olbermann, once said on his radio, on his rather television show on MSNBC before it was canceled, that I was the worst person in the world. So I just couldn't, it was a little guilty pleasure just to go over and say something. But the rest of them, I stayed by the fence. I'd say we had all this room in the press pen, as they call it, to maneuver. But I was actually on the air live for pretty much the entire speech. Donald Trump actually ascended to the podium that evening a little bit before 6 o'clock local time, and our show airs 6 to 9 on Saturday evening. So I didn't get a lot of chance to talk. Not that I would have wanted to talk to them anyway. I had a lot of people there in the crowd with this being a local event here in Memphis. A lot of people there who knew me, and I spent the time during commercial breaks talking with the folks.
Now, Trump Jr., he explained, too, that his interview with you, with the white supremacist radio interview, was an accident. So what happened there, and what did you get to ask him?
That's the question that everybody in the media wanted to know, and I didn't do them the dignity of offering them an explanation because they don't deserve it, number one. No. I mean, they didn't call to ask me. They didn't email me to ask me, you know, hey, some people are saying, are you a white supremacist? Is that in fact true? Are you an advocate of slavery? Have you ever owned a slave? You know, all of these things they were writing about me, they didn't call to clarify about any of that. They wanted the juice on how that interview came to be, and they wanted me to release the audio to them first. I'm not going to do any favors to these people. But it has come out. We've talked about it on the show since then. So basically what happened was, you apply for press credentials, and I didn't really care if I got them or not. I mean, I certainly believe that I deserved them. We are a legitimate radio outlet. We are members of the media. I mean, we're not nationally syndicated like, you know, Fox Radio or NPR, but we're on legitimate stations. So why shouldn't we have the opportunity to go there as members of the press? Because other members of the press don't like us. So, you know, I put in for those credentials with the Trump campaign on a Tuesday night, and I figured if they gave them to me, that would be nice. If not, I would go to the event anyway. And sure enough, on Friday, they get back to me and we get the credentials. And so I go, and the rest is history. And I guess everybody's read about it by now, or perhaps will after hearing this. But then on Sunday morning, the day after we cover the event as credentialed members of the press, I get an email from a third-party booking agent. Now, we didn't get an email directly from the Trump campaign. We certainly didn't get an email directly from Donald Trump Jr., but we got an email from, I guess, somebody that the campaign had hired to schedule interviews for Trump's sons. And he had emailed me directly, James Edwards at thepoliticalcesspool.org, asking if we would be interested in interviewing Donald Trump Jr. Well, I hadn't got an email like that before, so you certainly have to reason that this is because we've gotten the credentials and perhaps they'd looked into us. Who knows? And the Trump campaign definitely has plausible deniability with that because it was a third party. So I got back with him and I said, that would be great. I'd be happy to do it. They solicited the interview, or this agency solicited the interview. That should be something that people keep in mind. We didn't try to trick them or try to get them on. We didn't even ask. But the rub was that the only available time that Donald Trump Jr. had to tape this interview was on a Tuesday morning. Well, that doesn't work for me because I air live on Saturday nights. We could have gotten studio time, but there's shows going on during the only time he had availability. So I call a friend who hosts a show in Utah, and I said, you know, we have an opportunity to have Trump Jr. on. I can't do it. Do you want to take it? And he said, sure, that would be great. So he facilitated the interview. And then he said, well, since they emailed you to do the interview and you can't do it because of the conflict in time, would you like to sit in as a guest panelist on my show and we'll interview Donald Trump together, or Donald Trump Jr. together? And so that's how that actually happened. They emailed me. I couldn't do it. And so we brokered it through a third party radio program. and I guest hosted that particular
show. The press
show.
Made it sound like you hijacked your friend's slot and got in there slyly to ask questions. You know, they're such liars, dirty rats.
It's amazing. If you haven't ever had experience with the press, adjectives don't exist that can properly identify them. The depth of their depravity, there is no words to describe it. I mean, they are despicable. They're degenerate. They lie intentionally. And I'm not talking about, okay, it's their opinion that we're racist. It's the, you know, they use all of these words that they certainly wouldn't apply to members of any other racial group who are seeking to advance their unique interest. You know, of course not. Everybody knows that double standard. But I'm talking about, they absolutely just make things up.
Oh, yeah.
I'll give you, let me offer this one example of just some of the things we've had to put up with over the course of the last few days. One of the major networks, I can't remember if it was ABC, CBS, NBC. I mean, what's the difference, right? But mm-hmm. one of them had written on their, in their article that James Edwards claims on his website that his message is one of white power. Well, I've never used the words white power, as a matter of fact, to describe my work. So I actually emailed this guy because that is over the top. I believe that is libelous. And I said, you know, I've never said that. You didn't find that on my website. I would appreciate a retraction. He emailed me back and said, it was on your website last night.
What?
I said, no, it wasn't. I mean, what are you going to do with a guy?
Prove it. Where's your screenshot? Prove it.
Well, we went there. And then he texted me this, or rather emailed me an image where it said the political cesspool is unapologetically pro-white.
And
I
oh
said,
my
that
gosh.
Says pro-white. That doesn't say white power.
Yeah.
I said, there's a clear and substantial difference between one who is pro-white and one who is advocating for so-called white power or white supremacy. And he said, well, we believe them to be synonymous. So this is, you know, this is what's going on. And then there was one in the Detroit newspaper, the daily newspaper that services Detroit, Michigan, that said I was the leader of a Klan outfit. I mean, it's just total fabrications. And what are you going to do about it?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because he wants the media makes the rules. So I'm just talking, you know, they are, it's why I won't talk to them anymore. And that's what they'll do. They will, you know, when it comes to people like us, the narrative, the story is written in advance.
Oh, yeah.
And the facts bear no weight whatsoever. And what they'll do is they will go through, they will meticulously, and they get paid to do this, they will go through 10 years of radio archives, thousands of blog posts. They will pick one or two sentences, twist them out of context, and present that to the world as the sum of your entire belief in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Well, have you noticed too that white supremacy means different things to different types of people? To one, it means, you know, it's whites whipping non-whites into submission, right? Slave masters. And then to others, it just means white people basically being a majority or being supreme where they live. You know, they should be supreme in the lands that they built. I mean, no one talks about Chinese supremacy or African supremacy, right? Arab or Jewish supremacy. So what do they mean these days when they're saying white supremacy at you? Is it just white people existing in general? Because that's what it seems like.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's the way, you know, people like us would interpret that. I don't even think they could really define it. I think it's just meant to be a radioactive shut-up word. You know, it's not something you'd necessarily want to be called in polite company because it's going to make the kind of people that aren't initiated recoil from you. I mean, they could certainly say that we're European-American advocates, and that would be proper and certainly something that we would want to be identified as. You know, we certainly have to make the racial aspect of our work known because otherwise, you know, what separates us from any of the other so-called conservative outlets out there? I mean, we certainly have to make sure that people know that our message is one a little more robust than a little more muscular than the others. But with regards to the media's interpretation of these words, who's to say? You know, they use white nationalist and white supremacist interchangeably. Mm-hmm. It's as if they don't have even an elementary level of comprehension about what these words mean. It's as if they don't want to. And I, you know, it just different writers interpret these words in different ways. But nevertheless, you know they intended to inflict harm upon your reputation, so you have to do what you can to set the record straight. But there's very little you can do because you can't make them change it. And they know you're not going to have the money really to sue them either.
And unfortunately, they've kind of ingrained into people's heads the Hollywood version of a white supremacist. When you say it, it conjures up those, you know, movies of these, like, you know, rednecks with their swastikas acting like trash, right? That's what people think when you say white supremacist.
Well, yeah, no, it's even the people who are loyal supporters of your work here and of other organizations that are out there doing good work, they certainly wouldn't identify themselves. If you say, hey, well, you know, what are you all about? Oh, I'm a white supremacist. You know, none of our people would. None of our responsible people would do that. So, you know, the media's intention there is to defame.
So I wanted to talk about the Trump rally. So if you can describe the feeling at a Trump rally, what does it feel like? Because it is a movement.
It was everything that I think you would believe it to be. And, you know, I'm certainly on the Trump train. I mean, I voted for him here in Tennessee, of course, and I'm supporting him to the full extent of my abilities.
Isn't this the first time you've voted for a Republican, too? I think you said that somewhere.
Well, it will be the first time, assuming that they don't rob him of the nomination in some sort of convoluted convention, to assume that he goes on to be the Republican nominee. He will be the first Republican that I've ever voted for in the general election. I think I voted for Ron Paul once or twice, but I've never voted for a Republican in the general election. That goes back to the Buchanan campaign in 2000. But the feeling there was very palpable. Of course, the article that I wrote that spawned this international lavish media attention was posted to our website, I believe, at the beginning of March. If anybody wants to check it out at thepoliticalcesspool.org, I tried to the best of my ability to put into words and to articulate exactly what it was like to be there and the feeling. And there was something very real there. It was obviously highly energetic. It was very moving, a lot of passion there. And you could feel something, I believe, above and beyond that what you would find at a standard candidate's stump speech. There was something in the air. I don't know if I'm doing a very good job of painting a verbal picture here and putting my finger on exactly what it was, but it was inspiring.
It's almost like unconsciously they pick up on the fact that this is about white survival. Whether the people attending these rallies know it or not, what they really want is ethno-nationalism. Actually, last night, CNN actually used the term ethno-nationalists, right? And so the enemy recognizes what this awakening is before I think even the white people attending Trump's rallies see it.
I think you're really onto something there in the way you describe that. I think that there is an implicit and subconscious element of that in a lot of the Trump supporters. And we really have no reason to believe that Trump is even with us on race. But to me, I mean, we know for a fact that the others are diametrically opposed to what I say a lot is equal rights for all. And that would include our people, the equal rights for us to have freedom of association and to be proud of our cultural heritage and to celebrate our heroes and holidays, etc. But, you know, with Trump, we do know this, or we think we know this. And if he gets in there, if he wins the presidency and he completely pulls a 180, there's going to be no difference in that reality when compared to what we've witnessed every other president do. Yeah. They've either gone in there and been as bad as we thought or worse, or they've gone in there and completely just betrayed their base. I mean, the Republicans, this is what they're known for. So if that happens, so be it. We're not any worse off than we would have been if he hadn't run. But I think there is a chance. There is at least a chance that what are the biggest issues to me politically outside of the racial aspect, immigration, obviously, look, you can't have a first world country with a third world population.
Right.
If we don't stem this demographic replacement, we're done. And nothing else matters. So that is by far and away the biggest political issue one could tackle. And if he is sincere about building a wall, if he's sincere about coming down on employers that hire illegal aliens, then you wouldn't have to deport them. They would self-deport. So that's number one by a mile. Trade. Look, it's important that we have America First trade deals. I think that's something that resonates with a lot of working class people. And then, of course, his complete and utter irreverency for political correctness and his, I think he even said it. I'm not putting words into his mouth. I saw a headline in the USA Today where Trump was quoted as saying he hates the media, and rightly so. So on immigration, trade, political correctness, and the media, Trump is checking all of our boxes. And those are more boxes than we've had checked in a long, long time from a presidential front runner.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, sorry, go on.
No. This is your show. I'm used to radio hosting, so I hope I'm not.
That's all right.
Taking privileges.
You're here,
but
that you can speak.
So. And thank you for giving me the opportunity again, by the way. But with regard to Trump, I think there is a chance that we would have those things. And the media, getting back to that, I think people instinctively know now, whatever the media is against, they need to be for. And whatever the media is for, they need to be suspicious of. I have said on my radio program for years and years, even before I had any reason to believe this, just based upon the feedback that I've gotten and discussions that I have with people along my travels, I have always felt that fundamentally middle class, middle Americans have been with us on the issues. Now, they certainly don't have a hearty understanding of what's going on with regards to Jewish power and influence and the threats there with the media and the Supreme Court and things like that. But on the other stuff, you know, it's like Joe Sobrin said, even Joe Sobrin, who was an honest journalist who was fired from National Review for being too honest. And he was on my radio program before he passed away. Pretty famous writer here. He said that when it comes to their mating and migratory habits, liberals are indistinguishable from members of the Ku Klux Klan. And I bring that little anecdote up to prove my point that people fundamentally are with us. Even liberals, you know, they don't live in these neighborhoods that they wish for the rest of us to live in. And so, you know, people have been looking for a vindicator, an avenger for a long time, and they think they've got it with Trump. And there's a lot of hatred out there for the government, a lot of hatred out there for the media. And I don't mean hatred in terms of just some irrational, you know, bad thing. I mean, there's a such thing as a righteous anger.
Oh, of course.
Maybe that's what I should have said rather than hatred. There's a righteous anger towards the government and the media, and Trump's tapping into that.
Well, there were attendees, they were holding signs that were saying, you know, we're the silent majority. And I wonder, did they know what that means, that they're the white dispossessed majority? I wonder if that enters into their head. And then I think, are some of the people attending these rallies, did they know more than we give them credit for, or are they ready for our message? Do you think they are, some of them?
Yes, I absolutely do. I think implicitly they're already there. You know, there is still a threat. You know, it's unfortunate how much, you know, if you ask me to define myself, I think the first thing I would say is I'm a man. And it's a shame that when compared to our ancestors, you know, and I come from a long line of, you know, Confederate rebels on both sides of my family going back to the war. If a man in my family, whether it was on my maternal side or my paternal side, if they were old enough to fight, meaning if they were not too young, you know, little children or too old in their, you know, 60s, 70s and 80s, every man of age fought for the South and my family during that time. And so when you compare the sacrifices of blood and bone that real men gave for their people, you know, it really makes what we have to suffer in terms of defamations from limp-wristed journalists. There's really no comparison at all. So it is a price that that many are not willing to pay, but it's not really much of a price at all when compared to what's at stake. And there are instances, certainly, where people have lost their jobs or become social pariahs for being outed as someone who thinks rationally. You know, what we're talking about is just a very basic and healthy outlook on issues.
Yep.
And it doesn't mean that you hate people and want to seek their oppression or dispossession, but it just means that you love your family a little bit more than you love the guy next door. And that's at least the way I interpret it and the way that I present these arguments. I don't hate my neighbors, but they're not going to come into my house and eat my food.
Yeah.
You know, that's for my kids. And so that's what we're talking about. So getting back to your question, this is, I guess, a sort of a parenthetical answer, but I do think a lot of the people there are obviously very much with us. They understand that if they speak out, they don't want the glare of the media on them. It isn't something that's enjoyable. I certainly don't mind it, but it's not something that I hope up, say, man, I hope I can wake up today and see that the Wall Street Journal's called me a pro-slavery white supremacist. You know, you don't seek these things, but at the same time, if you understand that there is a cause greater than yourself, these things really don't amount to much. But unfortunately, most people right now still are not willing to pay that price, even though I think in the marrow of their bones, there's something there that's awakening.
Well, I think obviously white demographics, population replacement, immigration, it's the number one important issue. And whites need to understand that this is probably the last primary where whites will be the majority unless we do something now, because otherwise it'll be too late. And then if we become a minority, I think it's going to be hard times for white people in this country. So do you think maybe that's why the Trump primaries, they've set records in terms of reaching first-time voters, even Democrats voting Republican? Do you think that they sense the times that we're in?
I think that's some of it for some of them. There's no doubt about that. I couldn't say, well, this percentage of them is motivated by that reality or that they have an understanding of that. Of course, you know, you really, if you've ever gone to Walmart or watched any of these man on the streets interviews, it would be impossible to underestimate the lack of intelligence of the average American voter. Even though I say they fundamentally agree with us on these things, ultimately, they're still very low information voters. So I don't know how much of an understanding they have of that. I do think, again, that they are with us in spirit, but they haven't really put it all together and have a conscious understanding of it. Peter Brimelow is another guy that we have on our show from time to time, the editor of VDare. Yep. He wrote, of course, the book Alien Nation, talking about these things many, many years ago. And he said he had run the numbers and that whites could still elect a president well into the middle of this century. But that, of course, would mean that you'd have to have a candidate who would appeal to them, and you would have to have whites coming together, voting as a group block, just as Jews and Hispanics and blacks do, and voting for their interest. And so, of course, that's something that we really haven't seen yet. So I don't think it's the last time necessarily, but certainly it's, you know, the window is closing if we don't stop the porous borders. You know, it's not, you know, it's certainly not blacks that are busting at the seams with regards to population growth. It's the Hispanics and the illegal aliens and illegal or legal, it's the aliens. And so if you could put a cork in the border and then send these people back, that's effectively rewinding the time a few decades.
It's true. Yeah.
And so that's something that you have, and that's something that can be done. That's something that absolutely can be done and should be done. I mean, we were just talking about the enforcement of our laws. I mean, I think people could do that without having to dip into the race question at one bit.
Right. Well, you talk about secession. I support that as well. I talk about that. This country is just polarized beyond repair, in my view. I mean, people always say, stop dividing us. I'm like, we're already divided. We've been divided for a long time, and you cannot unite, you know, communists with nationalists. So do you foresee America breaking into smaller territories? Is secession something that could actually happen?
I hope so. You know, there's never been a nation. And of course, we understand the difference between a country and a nation. A country is a geographic plot of land, and a nation is a group of people bound by a common blood and soil. You've never had a nation endure that has embraced multiculturalism and diversity. And I, you know, you can go all the way back through the history of recorded civilization. You'll never find an example of a nation that has thrived once they become inundated with different cultures. And America is not going to be an exception to that rule. In fact, America is just tearing apart at the seams. You had much greater racial cohesion and goodwill between the races, even in the antebellum South, and even in the pre-civil rights era, the so-called pre-civil rights era South, than you do now. People of different faiths and beliefs and cultures and traditions will never coexist in the same living space in harmony. Now, that's not to say that we wish people ill. We don't. I don't. But at the same time, I do want to survive. I want, I guess the irony is people like us are seeking to ensure that diversity endures by ensuring that our people exist as a separate and distinct people.
That's right.
You know, if we all blend into this mocha colored mass of humanity, where's the diversity in that? And of course, that's something that I guess could trip them up. But I mean, their ultimate thing is that, you know, reason and logic, you're not going to be able to ever instill a sense of that into these people because there's no truth in them, Lana. And if there's no truth in people like that are representing our media, then we can have no common ground with them. And it does no good to attempt an argument with them. You know, I broke my rule last year. I had senior editor of the Washington Post wanted to do an interview with me, Jewish guy. And it was actually on my birthday. And I said, well, you know, this is the senior editor of the Washington Post. You know, we'll give it a shot because that's a newspaper of record. I normally just don't respond to anything unless it's live. And I spent an hour with this guy. I spent an hour on the phone with this guy last June. And, you know, they're always relatively polite. I don't think I've ever talked to a person, ever given an interview where they were just outright hostile and belligerent. Well, maybe one of the guys on CNN that I used to spar with, but he was fine. And, you know, again, very carefully, very responsibly tried to articulate to the best of my ability what it is that we're standing for. And then, of course, it comes out a couple of days later, white supremacists this, white supremacists that. So, you know, this is something that we're going to have to overcome, though, and we're going to have to understand. But America will not have been the first country to take a drastic turn and improve its situation and bounce back from the brink of utter chaos and ruin, if, in fact, that is to be our future, whether it happens through balkanization, which I think will be inevitable unless something changes radically from the head table in Washington. And I think Trump's the only guy that can realize that. And maybe it's better that Trump loses. You know, I don't know if our people have suffered enough to deserve somebody to swoop in.
Yeah, I've thought about that.
Them. So that's the only thing that gives me a little pause with Trump is that, you know, have our people really deserve to have this avenging angel come down if that is in fact what he may be? On one hand, I don't think they do.
Yeah.
And if it happens that easy, did we really learn a lesson? I don't know. It's just
people are still, like your book you wrote, Racism, Schmacism, you know, people are still terrified of the R word. I actually wanted to read something from the info page you wrote.
Sure.
It says, if you're like me, you've had it up to here watching the conservative movement spin its wheels, making lots of noise, but never going anywhere. You're fed up with attending tea parties and other protest rallies, hoping to make a powerful statement about big government, only to spend most of your time listening to a bunch of wimps insisting they aren't racists. You talk about how they spend half their time proving they're not racists, and then the other half of the time, of course, accusing Democrats of being the real racists, right? It's so true, and it's pathetic. So how has the R word come to be like a magical spell on conservatives? Because they're bending over backwards and inside out to prove they're not the R word.
I wish I knew, and I wish I knew what it was within my spirit and soul that led me to come to these conclusions that you can stand up and spit in the eye of the devil and live to tell about it. Yeah, I remember the first time back in 2006, we'd been on the air a little less than a year and a half. We went on the air in the fall of 04, and by the spring of 06, our reputation had preceded us, and so we started getting on all of these ridiculous hate lists. And I remember the media for the first time coming down on us real hard in the spring of 06. Now, this was before I was certainly as seasoned as I am now. But even then, I knew that apology was just not the right way to go. Because number one, we've done nothing for which we should apologize. And number two, it's not like they're going to go back and print, oh, well, he said he wasn't a racist. We're sorry. Yeah. They're not going to do that.
In fact, they'll attack you more. They'll sense weakness and go for it.
Absolutely. It's like blood in the water to a shark. And so, you know, as a man, you have to stand up and you have to dig your heels in and you have to stand on the solid foundation of our beliefs. And so that's what I did. But there's nothing that really makes me special. So this is the thing that I'm getting at is that I'm no different than anybody else. Anybody could do that. If I can do it, I can assure you that. And we've done it for many, many years. And we faced a lot of scrutiny and a lot of stories. But I wish I knew what it was about me and people like you, obviously, and some of the others. You know, we have so many fellow travelers and we share so many of the same friends. I wish I knew what it was about our people that the rest of our kinsmen don't have. And why they don't have it. But there's no doubt about it. They would, you know, they would rather denounce themselves and their families than be called a racist. And that's something we're going to have to outgrow.
Yeah, in your book, you gave some funny examples I wanted to read. What was it? White kid eating a ham sandwich around Muslims. Racist. White guy eating bananas around blacks. Racist, of course. You know, white flight, that's racist. I've even seen recently how Uber is racist because it's mostly white drivers going to white areas. I even saw something the other day about white people breathing cleaner air is racist. I mean, it's just getting so ridiculous. I think it's good that they keep going and keep it up at this level because it could be the best thing to wake up naive white people and just
The awakening is happening. And there was another example that we put in the book, and that book actually came out. It's amazing how quickly time goes by. but that was actually 2010 when we released that book. But one was the mayor of a city in Georgia apologized to a black woman who had complained that she had seen two police officers eating bananas while on their lunch break. And she said, obviously, they were eating the banana in front of her as a way to mock her. And the sitting mayor of the wow. city in Georgia issued her an official letter of apology saying that, you know, these two officers would be dealt with. So this is what we're up against. But I think people do see that. I mean, all of this stuff is cited with references in the book if people want to check it out. But I think obviously people see this and they are waking up in a very, very rapid way. If you go and look at the comments section on any racially charged article, any of these smear pieces, these hysterical attack pieces that appear, and it doesn't have to be about me or somebody we know, anything dealing with any sort of issue pertaining to race, and you read the comments section, I don't care what outlet it is, who it's written by, in the comments section, it's normally a little bit better than 50% of the people responding in a way that we would agree with.
Yeah.
If all of those people would get involved in supporting your work and supporting the work of others who are out there, this thing, I mean, it's already changing. I do believe it's changing. I think we're seeing much more positive things happen now than we did 10 years ago, and it's going to be exciting to see what the next 10 years hold. But if all of these people who are writing these comments, for instance, would get out and do something about it, contribute $5, go attend a meeting, it would be incredible. But I do think that there is something stirring out there in the hearts and minds of our people that is continuing to evolve, and it's going to be great to say at some point in the future that, you know, we were there before it was popular. We were doing these things before it was fashionable and trendy, and that'll be a day we can enjoy a nice drink in celebration.
Now, the neocons, Fox News, you know, the conservatives, they're really exposing themselves, aren't they? What do you think's next for the Republican Party?
You know, I think they'd rather burn down the house than give it to Trump. I think there's no doubt that they will attempt to wrest that nomination from him because and they really have nothing to lose. If you look at it from their point of view, if Trump is elected the president, there stands a good chance that he's going to clean house with a lot of these hangers on, these consultants, these lobbyists, these Republican strategists, you know, that are ubiquitous on all of these television outlets. You know, their day of influence and power is pretty much over, at least for the next 4 to 8 years if he wins the presidency. So for them, they would rather maintain what so many people in our circles call conservative incorporated, to where they continue. They would rather lose so they can continue to bring in money fundraising in opposition to Hillary Clinton than have a guy like Trump get in there and actually put forth legitimate solutions. And so it does look right now that unless he gets, I can't remember what the percentage was, 60-something percent of all remaining delegates going forward, that he's going to fall just short of the threshold to win the nomination on the first ballot. And some of these delegates are only pledged to him for that first round of balloting. And after that, they become free agents, depending on the state. So I think there is still a chance. I mean, there's no doubt he's going to go in there having won 35, maybe even 40 states and have a huge lead of several hundred delegates over Ted Cruz, who will inevitably be in second. But if he doesn't have enough to clinch it on the first ballot, I could certainly see the Republicans doing whatever it takes, by any means necessary, as they say, to stop him from becoming the nominee. And if that happens, you know beyond a shadow of a doubt then, if you're a member of the Republican base who have just suffered Stockholm syndrome for all of my lifetime, I mean, they have just been raped politically by these thugs and by these people in the Republican Party who have more in common, frankly, with Barack Obama than they do with people like us. And if that happens and they say, well, you know what, he won all of these states, he won all of these delegates, and they're going to pick a name out of the hat and give the nomination to that guy just because he's not somebody who can be bought and controlled by special interests in the Israeli lobby. Hopefully, if that happens, there will be a major reprisal for the Republican Party. So, and I guess that would be our consolation prize. If he can't become the president, if he can at least destroy the Republican Party, will that help? But then, you know, what happens after people forget? That's another thing. Yeah. We're still too comfortable. And as long as we've got football and beer and things like that, 4 years later, people forget that they got robbed of having Trump as the nominee, and they just don't, you know, they don't care as much. Time salves over a lot of things. So I tell you what, no matter how it plays out one way or the other, it's going to be a very interesting and turbulent summer politically here in the United States.
The Republican elites should just form their third party and just call it the Israel Party or the Liberal Republicans Party and just get on with it, you know? Jeez.
Well, if you know, I'm somewhat jealous of the parliamentary system that you know, Europeans have, because you know, certainly we would have a great deal of power through, you know, if Trump was representing his own political party, we would have seats in some sort of parliament. But yeah, it would be, well, and that's something that's on the table. I wonder how legitimate that is, that they would truly try and put an establishment Republican on the ballot as an independent just to guarantee Hillary's victory. I don't think that's as likely as them just screwing with the rules of the convention and in fact breaking whatever rules they need to in order to stop. That would be more palatable than the alternative. But I mean, again, these people are corrupt. So when you're dealing with corrupt people, I think we perhaps don't have the perceptive capabilities to look into what these people may try, because that sort of corruption isn't within the hearts of people like ourselves.
Exactly. Now, are you concerned about Trump's Israel stance? You know, I've put that aside because we're dealing with a lot of issues that need to be dealt with. And as you said earlier, dealing with some of them, checking off some of the boxes is better than none. Immigration is number one. And it also seems Trump wants to be neutral. In fact, he seems less of a warmonger than any other candidate. What do you think?
Well, this is a problem with our movement. And I get emails from time to time from people. I've listened to you for years. I've sent in contributions time and time again, but you said something on the last show that I disagreed with, so I'm going to have to part ways.
Aww, one, you know, disagreement.
Well, this, and sometimes it is literally one disagreement. It'll be over something, you know, inconsequential. I'm sure you run up against this as well from time to time, but this is something that I think afflicts. I've never been a part of any other movement, or so I don't know exactly how the other side operates, but I think that this is probably something that afflicts our people, because we are, in a way, much more independent minded. And I think it probably afflicts us or our supporters more. And it's something, again, that we have to be a little more mature in our outlook. If you're just waiting for somebody to write something or say something so you can have a beef with them, and I think some people in our circles do that, then, you know, you really need to take a look in the mirror and look inward. If you're dealing with people who have consistently stood the test of time and are doing their best, I don't agree with anybody 100% of the time.
No.
And so with regards to Trump, you know, we talked about immigration, trade, political correctness, the media. I mean, and he's good on other things too. Second Amendment, he seems to be good on, if you know, take his policy at face value. Israel. Okay, well, look at Israel. He did say he would attempt to be neutral, which got him branded, of course, as anti-Semitic. You have to be 100% in the tank for Israel, or you're an anti-Semite, don't you know? And then he also said at a meeting of fat cat Jewish financiers that, I know you're not going to support me because you can't own me. I mean, something in so many words to that effect. So, I mean, that right there is about as hardcore as anything you ever heard from Pat Buchanan or Ron Paul. And if he ran, though, I mean, I don't know how much more I would say to it than that. I mean, what more can you say? You're not going to let them own you, and you're going to be neutral. I mean, what more could we really ask for? I mean, certainly he says he's, you know, very pro-Israel and pro-this, pro-that. If he ran as someone who criticized or said anything with regards to Israel that was any harder than what the two examples we just put forth, there's no way he gets off the launch pad in the Republican primary.
That's right. He knows the game. He knows what he has to say.
He'd be dead in the water. I mean, he would be, if there were 17 candidates running, he would be number 17 in spite of everything else if he came out hard against Israel, which I don't even think is even necessary. I mean, a neutral approach is fine with me. I mean, I understand, you know, what's going on here, obviously, with the media and that, you know, the thing about the Jewish folks is that they're liberal. I mean, they're anti-white and they're anti-Christian. Yep. And, you know, they'd say, well, you're anti-Semitic. You hate them just because they're Jews. No, I don't. If every Jew out there was singing our tune, I'd be amongst their biggest supporters. You know, I can never be Jewish. I'm a white guy. But, you know, the problem is not that they're Jews and that the only reason we oppose them is because they're Jews. It's because so many Jews are radically leftist.
Yeah.
And with that, of course, comes things that are going to be antithetical to
the issues that we hold dear with regards to kith and kin and faith and things like that. So no, Trump would have been dead in the water, especially in the South.
I think it's interesting though, Bernie, you know, he's Jewish, but he never talks about Israel, or he hasn't even mentioned his stance on war. Not that I've heard in any of his talks. Have you heard him comment on that?
It's funny. I tried to watch. No, I haven't. But I haven't played as close attention to that side, obviously, as with going on in the Republican Party. But just as a casual observer of the Democratic primaries, I have not heard him make a big deal out of that. I guess it's just assumed that they're both going to be 110%, you know, whatever Israel wants, Israel gets, you know, from that side. But I tried to tune into a Democratic primary a week or two ago. It was this month, and the first 30 minutes were in Spanish, and they had, I think, a translator for the candidate so they could hear it. It was the most incredible thing. I thought it was like a joke. But and then they finally, switched to English, you know, after the introductions and the first few segments, and they switched to English. But I thought this was some sort of a parody, like a Saturday Night Live skit.
Yeah, it's hard to tell.
I couldn't even
anymore.
Find out about them if I wanted to, because I couldn't understand it.
Wow.
I don't know if anybody else saw that. It was the Univision sponsored Democratic debate.
Yep. And they were asking Hillary questions. That's right, in Spanish. They had to have translators. And of course, it's these people always ask questions about their people, their interests, their race. What are they going to get? But the minute a white person does it, white supremacists, get out of here, right? Have you noticed that? I mean,
oh my
blacks,
God, have I noticed?
I mean, of course, yeah.
Oh, yeah, about every day. I mean, that's just such a classic. I mean, we forget sometimes that even though that is just a very classic and fundamental hypocrisy that's employed, a lot of people really haven't put those two things together. We think that we're operating on an advanced plane because we've had this understanding for so long. People who may be tuning into your program for the first time maybe need to hear this. And that is, if you go to your local town hall meeting, you go to any of the, let's just keep in play what's going on here with the Republicans and the Democrats. You go to any of these town halls that they've held throughout the primaries, to any candidate, with maybe the exception of Trump, I think he would have a dignified silence, or he would somehow graciously move past it. But if you went to any of these other candidates' forums and you said, you know, Mrs. Clinton or Mr. Sanders or Mr. Kasich or Mr. Cruz, Mr. Rubio, what are you going to do as president to help Hispanic people? And they would have a great policy paper. What are you going to do to help the Jewish people? What are you going to do to help homosexuals? What are you going to do to help this group or that group? And they would have a very earnest and, they would wring their hands and take that question seriously. But then you ask that candidate, you know, as president, what are you going to do to help white people? And then, you know, and that's what you're getting at, obviously. I mean, the media would descend on you.
Oh, of course.
You would be.
Well, Bernie had said that white people don't know what it's like to be poor, and we don't know what it's like to be heckled walking down the street. Can you believe that?
So the only time you can mention white people is when you're bashing them or ridiculing them or mocking them or casting them as evil or insensitive. I mean, he's never been to the South. You know, that's another thing about a nation, though. A nation, you can't truly be a nation. I mean, certainly you have to have a common bloodline and you have to have a common culture. That a real nations are born through suffering. And outside of Germans, I don't think any other group of people have suffered like white Southerners have suffered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least not in recent history, obviously.
Reconstruction era? Awful. Horrible.
Well, that war was just a total war of genocide against the South. I mean, really, the war crimes committed against the South have been perpetuated. You know, they just kept that template and applied them to World War II and Dresden and many times over. But that all started, I think, as far as an American army doing that to its own people happened in the South. And anyway, getting back to Bernie's questions, I tend to go off on and elaborate. But the Southern people have suffered, the likes of which very few can understand. And obviously, I haven't suffered in that way, but my ancestors did. And you want to talk about poor. Try living in the South in the years after the war, and even still now in the rural South.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the standard of living is not anything that's going to make, Bernie Sanders jealous. And so there's still people, I mean, there's white people suffering all over the world. South Africa, I mean, there's white people suffering literal genocide today. Not much less not having a lot of money, even though a lot of whites in the South still don't. but and in other places too. I mean, being a poor white Southerner, I mean, there's poor white people all over the world and in all regions of the country. But I mean, yeah, but of course you can't bring that up. You can't do anything that would cause any sort of sympathy for whites or anything that would humanize whites.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, there's more poor white people in America than any other race, and yet we're supposed to be last in line for jobs and scholarships and all of this to affirmative action. It's outrageous.
Well, imagine a state-sponsored initiative that rewarded whites just based upon the color of their skin, and that's exactly what you have with affirmative action.
Yes.
I have no problem with the most qualified applicant getting the scholarship or the most qualified applicant getting the job or the promotion. I think if you just hold that, we don't have to discriminate against other races, and I wouldn't encourage that because that just plays into the hands of our enemies in terms of, you know, we're these evil people who can't get ahead. You know, white people would have never come up with all of these magnificent inventions and technological advancements and discoveries had we not subjugated other people, which is just preposterous. But this is the narrative that they use. And so we don't need to have policies that discriminate people of other races. I think we need equal rights for all and special privileges for none. If different cultures are going to be here, that should be the policy. I think it would be better for all, for everyone, if there was a separation, a peaceful separation. But we would do just fine under that. But unfortunately, what you have is, I guess, for lack of a better term, I don't really like this term, but reversed racist terms, policies that award scholarships and advancements and job placements on behalf of race.
Yep.
And of course, it's all for the benefit of everyone but whites. And of course, that's just through affirmative action. But you've also got quotas and set asides that just mandate a certain number of people of different races have to be in there, irregardless of their ability to do the job, irregardless of their intellectual prowess, irregardless of their intelligence.
They shouldn't even have that when you're submitting paperwork for scholarships or whatever kind of entry. They shouldn't even have the little check what race you are. So then they could just compare the best of the best without even being clouded with knowing if they're black or white or whatever, you know?
This is, again, one of those things that just causes intelligent people to scratch their heads. On one hand, they really try to convince people of the lie that race doesn't exist. Race doesn't exist. We're all one human family. And then at the other time, on the other hand, you have to check what race you are. So I guess you can be penalized if you're not a member of the support groups of the regime, if you will. So race doesn't exist on one hand, but it sure as hell matters when it comes time to divvy up jobs and scholarships.
Oh boy. Well, I wanted to ask you, you know, you've been in this movement for a while. It's been evolving. Even me in the last 4 years have seen a lot happen and things are changing. And I have critiques and I have good things to say. But have you thought about any tactics moving forward for our movement? What are some pros? What are some cons? Are we still kind of like, you know, babies in diapers, or where are we at?
Well, it's like I said before, I think we're a lot further down the road than we were 10 years ago. And not just in understanding and an ability to make a difference, but in terms of sheer numbers. And I think at the end, in some ways, sheer numbers and might makes right type of reasoning does come into play. I mean, you have to have the numbers. It doesn't matter how sound our arguments are if we're just operating in an echo chamber. It's hard to make plans because you're always going to have to evolve and roll with the punches, and you don't know what the other side's going to do, and you don't know what opportunities are going to present themselves. I mean, we could have planned all we want, and we could have never anticipated the rise of someone like Donald Trump, who has just transcended politics entirely. You know, a celebrity billionaire with the ability to control the media coming in and in some ways speaking out on issues that ring our bells. So, I mean, we could have planned, but we could have never anticipated that. So you have to be flexible. You have to be willing to adapt and ready to adapt. For my work, we'll just continue to do what we do. I think it's been effective, and it's been wonderfully, I use this to describe the ride sometimes, it's wonderfully turbulent. You know, we were denounced by the United States Congress. You know, the members of the United States Congress entered into the official record of a House Judiciary Committee
hearing. Was that during the Nathan Bedford Forest Grave incident? Or
No, this was, it was earlier that year. This was last year. This had to do with, we had interviewed a sheriff from Arizona, and he was testifying before the House Judiciary Subcommittee that was performing a hearing on immigration. And they had asked him about his appearance on our show. And in doing that, they entered into the official congressional record that they would like to denounce the white supremacist, you know, James Edwards. And the political. This is the United States Congress. And it was my own congressman, by the way, that did it, along with a few others that entered into it. So, and then, you know, but you mentioned Nathan Bedford Forrest. You know, last summer, this rage to eradicate the South of all of its Confederate flags and symbols monuments was really at a fever pitch. And just these people were just absolutely, if you've ever seen these horror movies, you know, the Resident Evil movie, they get the rage virus. And it was just, they thought that they were going to be unstoppable. And, you know, to me, I'm passionate about a lot of things, but I am not passionate about anything as much as family. And that's another thing, by the way, you know, if you want to be a hero for our cause, have children,
yep.
You know, be a man, be a husband, be a father, be a brother, and be a son, and have children and raise them the right way. I mean, that's number one. But so we have to look out for our future, but you're not a man if you won't defend your family. And so, you know, we talked a moment ago about the Confederate ancestry that I'm very proud of. And we actually do a month-long series every April, a Confederate History Month series. But when this was all at a fever pitch last summer, trying to tear up every flag and tear down every monument, you know, Nathan Bedford Forrest, who is, to me, one of the greatest American success stories of all time. If people aren't familiar with Nathan Bedford Forrest, he was, of course, you know, the very famous Confederate cavalry general. But what you don't know about him was that he was born one of 12, talking about poor white people, he was one of 12 children born into poverty in Tennessee. He had no formal education, no money. But yet he still rose to become a self-made millionaire, which I guess he would have been very close to a billionaire by today's standards. But he was a millionaire at the time in the antebellum South. He rose from having no education, born into poverty, to become a millionaire. Now, because he was a major planter, a cotton planter, he was exempt from having to serve in the war. He didn't have to fight. But rather than do that, not only did he enlist as a soldier of the lowest rank, he enlisted as a buck private in the Confederate Army. He donated the vast majority of his wealth to outfit Confederate troops. And then, in spite of having no formal military training, he didn't go to West Point, he didn't go to Virginia Military Institute. In spite of having no formal military training, he rose from a private to become what many consider to be the greatest tactician in the history of mobile warfare. He was a cavalry commander. And so, of course, he's buried here in Memphis, just to give you a little background information on Nathan Bedford Forrest. I mean, could you imagine a United States senator or a billionaire by today's standards enlisting as a private?
No.
You know, not one of these commission gigs where you just go over there and it's, you know, you're safe. I mean, enlisting as a private and dedicating the vast majority of their wealth to a cause that they believe in. But this was the kind of people that America used to produce. So I ask again, you know, what happened to the country that used to produce men like that? Compared to that kind of sacrifice, what we're up against is nothing. But anyway, we had all of these symbols were under attack. Nathan Bedford Forrest is buried here in Memphis. He has what I think is the most beautiful and inspiring equestrian monuments that has ever. You've got to see this bronze monument that sits atop Nathan Bedford Forrest's tomb. It's just mighty and perfectly appropriate for the kind of man that he was, and he was a man. And anyway, they, of course, are trying to dig up his grave here because it's in the middle of a city block here in downtown Memphis, and they want to dig him up and tear down the monument and move his bones. And awful. So we put together a... within a week, we put together a rally here when all of that happened after the shootings in Charleston last summer. And we turned out 500 people in a week, and we were expecting maybe 150. So that was a pretty incredible, you know, chapter in our legacy as well. And in fact, you know, as I think I might have written to your producer, we were contacted by the Department of Homeland Security and asked not to promote it on the radio program. And I mean, could you imagine a
really? Black Lives,
you know, you know, the Black Lives Matter people are a terrorist organization. I don't think that's putting it too bluntly.
Funded
could you imagine,
by a billionaire. It's not grassroots.
Right. Not at all. But could you imagine the Department of Homeland Security getting involved and saying, you know what, you can't have, I mean, these are people that literally tear down and burn down cities and get after cops. But I've never heard the Department of Homeland Security coming down on them.
No.
And we had the department, I mean, they were polite, but they said, you know, your permit only list, you're going to have this many. And we've been monitoring your social media presence. And it looks like you're going to turn out more. And if you turn out more than what you're contracted for, then, you know, we're going to shut you down.
What are they so afraid of?
We got, I don't know, because it was just the greatest people you could ever imagine. It was families, my children were out there. I got a 5-year-old daughter and a 1-year-old son, and my family was out there. And it was just a bunch of families. There wasn't even a piece of trash that was left there. It was just some of the greatest people that you could ever meet. And, you know, it was just a wonderful family-oriented event that we had there. And we had speakers and there was, you know, 21 gun salute and a band, and it was just a wonderful afternoon. But we had about 500 people show up for that in less than a week's notice. So it just goes to show that when people's backs against the wall, I'm not using this to describe our people, but even a rat will fight when his back's against the wall. And sometimes, you know, you have to be tempered by that fire before the greatness will rise to the top.
I agree. Absolutely. Well, as we wind down, you brought up something earlier, and I'd have to think about this myself to be able to answer this, but you brought up the words echo chamber. And I noticed that we do tend to get into that sometimes. I'm always looking at ways to get out of that or put myself in situations where I have to think different or find different words. So how do you go about breaking out of the echo chamber if you find yourself in that place?
Well, I've never... I run my program. I have a great team that helps me. And we've got a couple of co-hosts and, you know, producers and, you know, some network support staff and, you know, of course, a webmaster and, you know, a group of about a dozen guys that help me make it go. But I tend to run things authoritatively. I think some of the best organizations are run that way. I mean, it's fine if you can have an organization that has multiple voices that can operate in unison, but it's not very common.
No.
For our movement to have that. And if you look at the people that are really doing great work right now, it's people that are pretty much one man shows. Amarin and NPI, a couple of examples. But I've never really taken advice well. I will certainly listen to people. I'm not the smartest person in the world. There's people out there that have done more than me, and there's certainly people out there that are smarter than me. And I'll always, I think any reasonable leader will solicit the opinions of others, but at the end of the day, you've got to make your own determination. And there's some things that we do in our program that other people in our movement are not doing. And that gets back to, I think, something that with regard to the echo chamber, you know, if you look at our statement of principles, you'll find some things there. I mean, we certainly cover the Southern issue a lot more than others do. And we cover things from even a pro-Christian perspective that a lot of people aren't doing. But at the end of the day, the show exists to be an avenue for pro-white thought. And this other stuff is important to me because it's a part of who I am. And so I let my personality, and I have a real intimate relationship with my audience in terms of, it's really a family. I consider them to be part of the family, and they have responded with a lot of loyal support and commitment over the years. But so I think if you have independent-minded leaders who will work together in spite of any differences for the greater good, and that's important because sometimes we're susceptible to letting random beefs or disagreements blur our, not us, but other people, certainly not me, but other people have done this, and you let that blur what the ultimate goal is. We can't do that. But I think it is important that there is a difference of opinion within our movement. And it just goes to show with this, you know, discussion that we've had today, we've existed in the same universe, your program and my program, for a number of years now. And I know, I think Red Ice goes back all the way to 2004, if I'm not mistaken, right?
10 years, yeah.
You know, we've existed in the same universe for many years, but we have never had our orbits cross paths until today. Yeah. And I think that's actually a good thing. And that's a testament to the fact that our movement is getting so big now that not all of the major players are working in, you know, lockstep with one another.
I think it's good because you cast a net somewhere, we cast a net somewhere, and then when we come together, we bring those nets of people together. I mean, that's how you do it. I think there's these node points in alternative media or pro-white media that can come together and rein in a larger audience, and I think that's a good thing.
Well, what y'all have done has been so inspirational with regards to, well, and I agree with you, of course, and it is important because, you know, ultimately, we have to come together racially. We have to come together and have a solidarity as a race, or, you know, all of this other stuff that we consider to be important, and it is important, but it's not going to matter if we don't unite. You know, when you talk about minorities, people forget globally whites are far less than 10% of the global population.
Yes.
So whites are the real minority. And I don't think it's a wise tactic to play the victim game. Oh, woe is me. But, you know, as far as minorities go, yeah, we're still a majority in the United States for now. And that's rapidly changing. And it will change. It will change forever if we don't do something. But globally, we're still very much a minority. But it's true. We have to come together as a race. And I think that our people are beginning to do that a little more. And what I was saying was, what was so impressive is that I'm probably the oldest 35-year-old you'll ever know. I'm not very proficient. Technically, I'm not very web savvy. We had some people put together a Facebook page for our show a few years ago, I think back in 07, 08. And we had a few thousand people sign up in the first week or two and friended us, whatever you call it. And then, of course, Facebook just, you know, took us out. So I haven't gotten into the new age, the new mediums of Twitter and Facebook, perhaps as much as I should. And some people criticize me for that. And that's not necessarily unfounded, but we haven't done that. We have the website. We have the radio show.
Yeah, I was looking around on Twitter. I think there's an imposter political cesspool. I went there, and I think it's some spam account too.
There, every now and then you'll see something like that with, you know, a handful of followers or whatever. But no, we don't have any social media presence outside of. That's interesting. What the Department of Homeland Security said our social media presence. Well, we don't even have anything except the radio show. But
so what are they really looking at? Maybe they're spying behind the wall, huh?
Well, people had taken our article promoting the Nathan Bedford Forrest event and posted it, I guess, to a bunch of different Twitter and Facebook feeds. But we don't have to actually have anything. But anyway, long story short, it's really inspiring what y'all have done. And not just y'all, but to see so many Twitter accounts. See, I'm showing my ignorance here. I don't even know what the Green Frog is all about. But you know, to see, you know, when
the
I see
life
him,
of
I know
its
this.
Own. Yeah. It's hilarious. I love it. I see it everywhere all the time, too.
When I see that Green Frog, you'll have to explain it to me later. But when I see the Green Frog, I know this guy is going to have something good to say, whoever's got that avatar. But there's just so many people out there. Where were these people 10 years ago? They existed, certainly. Perhaps they're wiser now and more cultivated now than they were then. But these people were around. But a lot of our folks have really done good work, far better work than me, in terms of tapping into the social media currents and bringing our people together. And a lot of these, you know, feeds will have thousands of fans and friends and followers, and you add all of that together, and you've got a real base that can enact real change.
That's
positive
right.
Change.
That's right. Well, James, I wanted you to share any closing thoughts, and of course, share your show and website info for all our listeners.
Well, the website is thepoliticalcesspool.org. That's the name of the show, and we're on AM radio here in the United States, based in Memphis, but people can catch us anywhere, thanks to the simulcasting audio that we have at our website. And every show we've done all the way back, we started in 2004. We started archiving the broadcast in the spring of 05. So nearly every show we've ever done is available online. We've had some great guests, you know, some big name guests and some guests that have made a lot of news for us. And it's all there at your fingertips if anybody's interested, thepoliticalcesspool.org. And I want to thank you again, Lana, for extending to me the invitation. It's always good to grow our social networks and work in cooperation with people who are pulling in the right direction. And again, I really admire what y'all have done and what you've built.
Well, thank you. My pleasure. Thank you so much. I should add that this Saturday night, I will be a guest on James's show, The Political Cesspool, at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, live. Also, I haven't been on Facebook that much. It really just seems like it's on its last fumes. So find me on Twitter under Lana Lochteff or Radio 314. Greg Johnson is coming back on Radio 314, and we'll discuss gays, women, Trump, his new book, and much more. I know it'll be a good one. Also coming up is David Whitehead, and we'll discuss The Way of the Truth Warrior. And later, a beautiful young woman who runs the channel Blonde in the Belly of the Beast. Visit radio314.com or redicecreations.com to check for my latest shows. Also, check out my clothing line at lanaslama.com. I have a sale going to get ready for new stuff. If you want to help support what we do at Red Ice, please sign up for a Red Ice membership or consider a donation. It helps us grow. Visit redicemembers.com and click on subscribe for more info. Have a productive week. We'll talk soon.
And I said, what's going on? And who knows what it is? You know, the famous Trojan horse. I mean, is this a Trojan horse? I read this the other day and I said, wow, that's really amazing. That's really incredible. And it's the snake lyric. On her way to work one morning, down the path along the lake, a tender-hearted woman saw a poor, half-frozen snake. Take me in, O tender woman. Take me in, for heaven's sake. Take me in, O tender woman. Sighed the vicious snake. Now she clutched him to her bosom. You're so beautiful, she cried. But if I hadn't brought you in, by now you might have died. She stroked his pretty skin, and then she kissed and held him tight. But instead of saying thank you, that snake gave her a vicious bite. I saved you, cried the woman, and you've bit me. Heavens, why? You know your bite is poisonous, and now I'm going to die. Oh, shut up, silly woman, said the reptile with a grin. You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in.